This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Roy Tennant. He's had a long career in libraries and helped usher librarianship into the internet age at University of California, Berkeley, the California Digital Library, and OCLC Research. He's also the creator of Current Sites, one of the longest-running digital publications ever. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from Mometrics and from listeners just like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com/support. With library budgets constantly shrinking, it's getting harder and harder to provide the resources your library patrons want and need. That's why the folks at Mometrics Test Preparation created the Mometrics e-Library. Through their e-Library portal, Mometrics offers study guides and practice questions for over 1,800 different exams covering college entrance, graduate school, nursing, medical, teacher certification, civil service, I'm counting this on my fingers, I'm running out of fingers, and many other careers and fields of study. All fully customizable and at a fraction of the cost of printed books. It's like having an entire library of test prep materials all at your fingertips. So, save space, save paper, and save money with Mometrics e-Library. To get a free demo and 10% off your first purchase, visit goelibrary.com and let them know you came from Circulating Ideas by using the promo code PODCAST. That's goelibrary.com, promo code PODCAST. Roy Tennant, welcome to Circulating Ideas.
Thank you.
So you've had a long career in libraries, and you were kind of in the field and doing good, important things during a big time of change in the 80s, 90s, as libraries were getting into technology, and we'll kind of walk through some of that. But you are now retired, so I wanted to start out with asking, how is retirement treating you?
It's great. I highly recommend it to everyone. It's great to be able to manage your own time and do what you want and not do what you don't want.
We don't always get to have that luxury, but
I know we don't.
Well, can you talk a little bit about how you got involved in libraries in the first place? Like what your kind of childhood with libraries were and how that became something that you wanted to do for a living?
Yeah. Well, I got started in libraries early, when I was 17 in Indiana. I volunteered at the local public library, and I really enjoyed that. But as soon as I turned 18, I gathered all my small amount of dollars together and took a bus back to California, where I'd actually spent most of my life at that point. And eventually got involved with a summer work program. This was during a economic downturn, and I was living in a county that had double-digit unemployment. And this program would put youth to work at various locations, and I ended up saying, hey, I'd like to work at the local library. And in this case, it was a community college library. And so I worked there for one summer in that program, and I ended up getting hired there. And that was essentially how I got started in libraries, first at a public library, but then at a small community college. And I ended up working at every level of the higher education system in California. So after I worked at the community college, I went to a state college, Humboldt State, and then from there, University of California at Berkeley.
Yeah, and when you were first getting started, obviously you got into technology pretty quickly in your career, but when you were first getting started, what was it about the library that appealed to you? Because obviously there wasn't too much technology stuff back then. I mean, we were getting into it there, but what was it that was appealing to that 17-year-old Roy?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not quite sure what it was, but I've always been an avid reader, and although I have a very checkered history, I should say, that I was essentially a school dropout. Well, my last year of public school was the eighth grade. I spent 2 years in an alternative school. This is all in California. And so essentially by the 10th grade, I was a complete dropout. But I read constantly and I don't know how to put it, but I'm actually fairly intelligent, and so libraries appealed to me just as a concept, I guess is probably how to put it.
Well, when you were in college, you it looked like you minored in computer science. Did you know at that point that technology was going to be something that was going to be important with libraries, or did you not even know you were going to get into libraries at that point? When did you kind of make that connection that these two things were going to be intertwined?
Yeah. Okay. And this, something that runs through my career is luck and timing. And this is certainly one of those situations, because I was working at this small community college in the foothills of Sierra Nevada, Columbia College, in the late 70s, early 80s. And it was in the early 80s where I decided that I wanted to go and get my master's in librarianship. But I didn't even have my BA at that point. So I started kind of thinking about that. And at the same time, microcomputers had come on the stage. And so I had access to a Commodore PET computer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of immediately knew that computers are going to be important in libraries, because libraries were all about information. And what do computers do? They manipulate information and all that. So I knew from the get-go that computers are going to be important in libraries. So one of the first things I did was I learned to program in BASIC. Really, really badly, by the way.
Hello.
Embarrassingly bad. You know, go-to statements everywhere. It was horrible. But I actually programmed while I was still at Columbia College. Before I went into college in a serious way, I programmed a library orientation program on the Commodore PET. Mm-hmm. And this is actually loading off a cassette tape. This is how, like, ancient this technology was. But, you know, right around that time, I was also getting serious about, okay, I need to go get my degree, and looked around at various colleges and ended up deciding to go to Humboldt State. And I knew that even though computers are going to be very important in libraries, I couldn't quite stomach the idea of majoring in computer science, because at the time, and, you know, all the computer science classes were held in the basement, essentially.
Right.
And I don't know why, but that's just the way it was. You know, you had all the computer labs were in a dark room somewhere. And I just, that didn't appeal to me, but I knew it was going to be important. So I knew I had a minor in it. So then I started casting about for a major that I wanted to take. And I discovered in a community college in Eureka, College of the Redwoods, which is where I went to get my second year of community college before going into Humboldt State to get my BA, I ran into an instructor in my geography class who just made it come alive. And geography, I realized, was my love, because it's a study of everything. And I'm a very holistic person. I like mm-hmm. the 30,000 foot view. I really don't like getting down in the weeds that much. So then I decided, okay, geography is going to be my major. And that's what I majored in at Humboldt State. Although I still wove in the computers there, because I actually worked for one of my geography professors who was doing some work on climate. And I wrote some software for him, and I believe that was in Fortran, that would run on the mainframe, which was interesting, because back in the day, as some of you might remember, probably not you, but others, you'd submit your program and it would run on the mainframe, you know, whenever they could schedule it. And then you'd have to go somewhere and pick up the printout of what happened in your program. And the printout could simply say, you know, it failed, which is like classic, right? Because you're going to make a logic error, which I'm very good at. And, so then you've wasted a day or whatever, and then you're back to square one. So that was a kind of a rough time in computers, because you wouldn't get the immediacy of failing right away.
Right.
Anyway, went off on a tangent, but that's what it was like.
And do you feel like in those early days of that, do you feel like you were librarians in general were going along with that, or did librarians in general have to be dragged into it? I feel like it's more like they were dragged into it, but you were there. So.
No, that's no. You have it right. You have it right. And in fact, that's kind of how I spent my career in the 90s, was dragging people into it. Well, late 80s into the 90s. So, excuse me. So at Humboldt, again, this gets down to luck and timing. I was working as staff there because I had had some experience in libraries. And so I got a staff job. And I was there right when they decided to automate their circulation system. And so I became one of the key people then that jumped in to do that. And that experience lasted me the rest of my career, because the nature of that change was so dramatic, and that everything, all the procedures in the circulation department, every single one of them changed. And we had to come up with brand new procedures and documentation and training and all these things that later I would fall back on that experience at UC Berkeley when we were doing some of the same things. So that was instrumental in kind of the formation, I guess, of my professional outlook and abilities, was the automation of circulation at Humboldt State. Then when I graduated, I went to UC Berkeley, again, got a staff job. And within like, was it a year or two? Within 2 years, I think, excuse me, I had taken over as the automation coordinator at UC Berkeley, because the person who did it went to Reed College. And in that position, I was responsible for leading barcoding projects of the hundreds of thousands of books that need to be barcoded, documentation of the automated system, which was an internal system that Berkeley had actually created called Gladys. And all these things related to automation, which just, again, used the experience that I'd had at Humboldt. So the timing there was just perfect. And that's kind of been a thread throughout my career. The timing just has worked.
And to be clear for the listeners, this is going from literally the card catalog to what you're talking about, barcoding, yes, and everything, right? I mean, yes. This is like date due cards and stamping things and keeping paper logs and all this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And in fact, Berkeley had worked for a number of years before I arrived in getting the card catalog digitized. So getting digital records for all of their card records. And that was kind of essential to kind of have the infrastructure with which to do the automated circulation. So a lot of that had already happened, or was actually finishing up as I arrived on the scene. So that was kind of an essential first step, actually.
And one of the things you did to help in that sort of dragging librarians into the future thing is you had the Library Technology Watch program. Can you talk about what that was and why you wanted to create that?
Okay, so when I was at UC Berkeley, I fell in with someone who was actually tremendously instrumental in my career, Ann Lippo. And she was a force at UC Berkeley, and she was the instructional coordinator. So she would create and manage teaching programs for not just staff, but also faculty. And she sucked me into her teaching program. And in fact, I can remember, you know, walking the halls of Doe Library, and if I saw her coming, I'd duck into a side door to prevent her from like seeing me and going, "Oh, Roy, why don't you teach this class?" But she was so successful in doing that that I ended up teaching a lot of the dial-up classes. Mm-hmm. So these were the back in the day. It's amazing we have to explain this, but yes. Back in the day, computers weren't connected. Mm-hmm. Wow, what a concept. So you had to have a modem and dial into another modem to connect to a computer. And for us, that was dialing into the catalog. Mm-hmm. So I actually created the handout on how to set up your computer the settings and all this for your modem and whatnot, and where to dial in and how to get help and all of this. A one-page handout that summarized how to dial into the library catalog. And also then use that as part of a packet of handouts to teach people how to dial into the catalog. And so that was kind of the beginning. And then we just went from there. And Anne was such a visionary. And she realized that the internet, just like I realized the internet, was going to be absolutely instrumental to libraries. And she was intent to make sure that her colleagues would understand that and know how to use it. And that's what led to the whole the workshop called Crossing the Internet Threshold. And that was preparing for that workshop. It was essentially a one-day workshop, but she wanted to do two cohorts at ALA when it was in San Francisco, and would begin with, one cohort would end with, and the other cohort would begin with, kind of a lecture talk by Clifford Lynch. Mm-hmm. And preparing for that one-day workshop was so difficult, but also it really focused us. We had to create handouts on all these various technologies like Telnet and FTP and, at that point, Gopher, and all this technology that we're trying to teach people, listservs and BidNet and, you know, all these things. So in creating all those handouts for that workshop, Anne eventually realized that we had a book. And so the workshop was really the locus for coming up with a book, which was actually one of the first dozen books about the internet for the layperson, like, ever. Mm-hmm. And it was the first book about the internet for librarians. So that actually just then launched my career really into the stratosphere, where it became speaking gigs and teaching gigs and all these other things, writing opportunities. But it was her vision and her sucking me into her world that made that possible. So yes, when I was at Berkeley, I of course immediately gravitated to technology. And first it was the automation of circulation. But then when that kind of, we got a handle on that and we were pretty much up and going, I was looking around and the technology world was just on fire. And this is back in the day when, for example, CD-ROMs had come along, and CD-ROMs were just blowing print periodical indexes right out of the water. And we would have students lining up to search the CD-ROM database and waiting for it when their backs were turned to print indexes. Mm-hmm. And excuse me, so they were like completely taken to this technology, and it was just one of many technologies. I don't know if you remember, we had laser discs mm-hmm. back then.
Yep.
So we'd have like movies on laser disc, and so these changes were coming along. Just every year there was something new. And I was looking around, looking at this landscape, and realizing that we were scrambling. I mean, literally staff were just like, you know, like deer in the headlights kind of situation. And said, what could help our staff get up to speed on all these new technologies? And I realized that one of the ways we could do this is by getting a cohort of volunteers who would choose one technology to really understand and boil down and summarize and teach to the rest of us, so that we all didn't have to become experts in everything. We could just, you know, rely on these experts to tell us what we needed to know and no more than that. And so that's when the idea for the Library Technology Watch program began. And so I put forward this proposal to administration. I said, this is what I want to do. I want to get some, you know, half a dozen people, volunteers, librarians, and excuse me, and cover these six technology areas. And at the time, there were things like the internet, CD-ROMs, you know, I forget what they all were, but at the time they seemed to make sense. And so somehow I was able to get approval for this. And so I was the team leader. And essentially what happened is these people would just donate part of their time from their day job, if you will. So they were working in various branches of the library, and they'd spend, I think we allocated something like 25% of their time to do this activity. So I brought the group together, and we were talking, and we decided that one of the things we wanted to do was to create this current awareness publication called Current Sites. And the idea here was that we would scan the literature, again, on behalf of our colleagues, because it's a daunting thing to do if everyone's doing it on their own. And we would pick things we thought were important, and then we'd summarize them in one paragraph and tell them some key findings of that article, or this is what that article is about, so they could decide if they wanted to go read it. And that was kind of the idea. And we started this in print to begin with, and laying out on a Mac in a desktop publishing program. But then quickly word of this spread, and Clifford Lynch said he'd like to put this on Melville. And Melville was the UC-wide library catalog system, again, an in-house system. And they had the ability to put on publications, if you will, within the catalog. So it was like another section you could go to in the library catalog to just read things. And so he wanted to put it on there. So we probably within the first 6 months, we were essentially online. And this is back in the early 90s. We started in August 1990. So this would have been like in 1991. And this is very early days, of course. And so we are the second longest internet-based publication that's out there. The other one, the first one is Tidbits, which is a publication about the Apple computer by Adam Engst. And he's been longer than Current Sites by months, not years, but months. So we've been continuously publishing every single month since August 1990, which I think is a pretty stellar publication history.
Yes.
And just to give you perspective on that, my twins are now 26, and they were not born when we began it. So...
It's interesting because it's kind of where we still are now today. People are still looking for things like that. I mean, it's kind of RSS before RSS feeds, and it's kind of
right.
Twitter before Twitter. It's a lot of people use Twitter for that, of curating articles and things. So that it kind of presaged all that by decades of the need for people to go to one place and get their stuff. I mean, that's what I loved, you know, Google Reader for the longest time. Was I can put all my stuff in one spot and get it. And that's really what you were doing before that infrastructure even existed.
Yeah. Now, having said that, I've decided this year that I'm going to step down. So I'm going to be looking for whether someone wants to take it over or not. And that can be rather daunting, because the infrastructure I have for producing it is fairly specific and very Unix command line based, and I don't think anyone wants to do that. So it would entail kind of coming up with a completely different way of producing it.
Right.
So later on this year, I'll be putting that out on the listservs and seeing if anyone wants to step forward. If not, then we will close out a very long publication history later on, well, next year. So.
Well, listeners, you heard it here first. So start thinking if you want to take this over, and you can contact Roy. So
that's right. This is the very first, beyond the Current Sites team itself, the very first announcement of that. So yes.
And how does it work? Does it still work basically like it did back then? I mean, do you have like a small group of people that have certain subjects they read about and things like that?
Well, no, it's more informal. So they're not assigned a subject, but they have natural tendency to you know, drift towards certain things. So, for example, Peter Hurdle, he's more likely to deal with intellectual property issues and, you know, those kinds of things. And we all have kind of various publications we look at and that kind of thing. But it stopped being a formal thing. In the early days, we would actually have publications that we were assigned to monitor. And then we kind of drifted away from that over the years. So Nowadays we're mostly like citing blog posts and we still cite journals, of course, but a lot of what we cite is online, which is natural.
Well, another not quite as long running as that, but another long running one is the Web for Lib, and even and then later XML for Lib, electronic discussion boards. I mean, are those both still going as well?
We shut down XML for Lib, but Web for Lib is still going. And I have to say that I just want to say a few words about how Web for Lib
Yes,
started.
please.
This is back in the early to mid 90s, and UC Santa Barbara had started Gopher Lib for Gopher, and I was a member of that, and I found that terribly helpful. And then this is around the time that UC Berkeley was deciding what to do about putting up a library information system online. And so we already had a Gopher, but we wanted to do something around, well, I shouldn't say that. This is back in the day when we were looking at everything. So we originally made the decision, and I want to get this out there because people need to know about mistakes. We were looking at a Gopher and a line mode web, which at that point there was no Mosaic. It was just the CERN line mode browser. And so we were deciding what information system put up, and we were comparing Gopher to the line mode web, and we thought, okay, why should we put our staff through the pain of doing HTML when Gopher is so easy? And there doesn't seem to be all that much more benefit. There's some benefit, but not a huge amount of benefit from doing this line mode web thing. And so we decided to go with Gopher. And that ended up being a huge mistake, because as soon as Mosaic dropped in the summer of 93, we realized that the web is the future. And at that point, we had everything in Gopher. And that meant that we had created this huge transition problem. And if I had to go back and do it all over again, I never would have had Berkeley adopt Gopher. But at the time, it seemed like the right decision. And I think that's partly where problems come in, is you can only deal with the information that's in front of you, but sometimes we might have made a different decision if we'd looked forward a little bit more and we said, this has more potential to be more interesting than Gopher. In any case, once Mosaic dropped and we saw that the web was the future, we knew we'd have to create a website for the library. And so I was tasked with leading the group to do that. And I started looking around and saying, well, how the hell we go about doing this? And I had a lot of good experience with using the Gopher listserv. And so I approached administration at Berkeley about starting a web listserv, and got permission to do that. And at that point, we were using some odd technology. It wasn't actually listserv, it was something else. Anyway, we got that set up and announced on the Gopher list, and it just immediately took off. It was like people were ready for something like that because, again, it was the time when the web was looking really hot and there was nothing out there yet for libraries. So that just took off to such an extent that, like, our heads were spinning. And I don't think administration had bargained on it being so popular. But just to say a few things about the early days on listservs, that was a real eye-opener for me as well, because as a manager of that listserv, we had to weather some real controversies and some real problems. And I think that we took the right attitude about how to manage the listserv, and that's this. We did not set up any, and I say we because I quickly established an advisory board to help me. Well, this wasn't immediate, but it was like over some years I established this advisory board so that I'd have a sounding board for some of the decisions I was making. But one of the key decisions I made was that no rule for listserv would get established a priori. So in other words, only problems could make rules get established. And so we ended up with a very small set of rules, but they were crucial. And it was kind of like, you know, don't be an asshole kind of rules,
right,
you know?
Right.
Because that would get you kicked off. And in its history, I mean, I warned a number of people. So I would say, you know, if you continue this way, we may have to remove you. But I think I only ended up only kicking off two people in the end, in the entire history, and blocking them just through behavior issues. Because, you know, again, these were early days and people were still learning how to be, you know, good citizens, if you will, of a discussion like this.
Right.
And I can't say that we've learned anything as a people.
I was going to say.
Because it's just gone on and on and gotten worse and worse.
Right. See current day Twitter.
Yes, exactly. But I'd have to say that it did become a civil place and has remained one. And it's been interesting to me that, you know, we had all these, you know, knockdown, drag out fights over like censoring the internet that like went on for years. And now there's not like even a peep of controversy, it seems. So, you know, those are strange times. You know, everyone was like, it was like, hey, our house is on fire. And now it's more like, hey, isn't our house cool? You know, it's great.
That's good. Well,
yeah, no, it is, but it's very different times.
Well, after you spent a long time at Berkeley, you moved over, still within the university system, over to the California Digital Library. Can you talk about
Yes.
what kind of projects you did when you were working there?
Yeah. I was recruited to initially create the website for the e-scholarship initiative of the California Digital Library. And in fact, I was the first quote-unquote employee of that initiative, even before they hired the director, because they wanted to kind of establish a presence for it. But that quickly morphed into essentially being the technology director. So one of the things I think I'm most proud of my time, there were two things essentially. One was that we pioneered a way to publish books online in XML. And what would happen was I wrote this program to use an XSLT style sheet to render the chapters of the book from XML into HTML. And this is on the fly. So initially I pioneered a way in which you could even choose things like the background and font color, the font size, things like that, and then have it render in your particular style sheet, if you will. So I was doing things kind of dynamically that way. And this was back in, you know, the early 2000s where no one was doing this kind of thing. That eventually led into the whole infrastructure that they created, they programmed in order to publish XML on the web that now powers pretty much everything. But to back up for a moment, the other thing that I'm most proud of is we tackled the whole idea of an institutional repository way back in those early, you know, 2000 area, mm-hmm. back when ePrints was like the only software out there really to work with. And so we initially stood up an instance of that, of ePrints, and then we were working with faculty. And at this point, it was me and Catherine Candy, who's the executive director of eScholarship. And we'd go to the faculty and we'd say, hey, you know, we have this thing, you know, would you put your papers in this? And there was something like, at one point I counted, I think there was something like 13 screens you had to go through to upload a paper. So essentially it was a non-starter. Right. I mean, there was no way the faculty were going to do this. So we, you know, spun our wheels there for a while, and then we were looking around and we had two breakthroughs. One was a software breakthrough. And we found BPress, which was, it's not surprising we found this because a couple UC Berkeley faculty in economics had created it. And it was a system for publishing journals. And so it was all built around publishing a journal. But we looked at that and we said, you know, we really loved their upload system, which was like essentially two screens instead of 13. And we were thinking, you know, this isn't far away from being a repository system. And if we make it be a repository system, then we'll have both an institutional repository kind of software as well as a journal publishing platform. And what's not to like about that? So we talked to BPress and we essentially paid them to dumb it down, if you will, into a repository on one side and then keep the journal publishing platform in the other. So we ended up with this really simple, easy to use system for uploading papers that could either be a journal or just an institutional repository. And then they went off and marketed that as digital commons. But it was us who actually made that happen. The other breakthrough was we realized that faculty would never do this. It doesn't matter how easy it was, they would never do it unless there's much more in the game for them. Mm-hmm. And so we focused on training faculty secretaries to do this because they were the ones who, if faculty put up papers at all on the web, it was the departmental secretary who was doing the work. And so we just made their lives easier. And so that was the model that actually then tended to work, was forget the faculty, focus on the departmental secretaries, and then get a platform that's actually easy to use. And then we were just off to the races. And now they're just really successful. I'd say they're the single most successful university publishing program that I've seen out there. They're just doing amazing work. And the problem is they don't, you know, ring their bell enough, because I think if more people knew about what they were doing, they might be able to emulate some of the things they're doing.
Right. Yeah, well, that's one of those things that we always want to share what we're doing more so that people can implement it themselves or put their own twist on it. So, sometimes the sort of natural, I don't know, humbleness of the library sphere can work against us.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
I've actually seen this more for libraries in other countries. So, for example, one time I was traveling, I was lecturing, well, giving talks, workshops in Australia. And this is back in the 90s somewhere. And I was talking about digitization. And at that point, digitization, you know, digitizing like photos or other content, putting it online was still in its nascency. This, you know, Library of Congress is still coming up with ways to do this, you know, in documentation on it and everything. And so there I was, the expert from US, talking to these Australian librarians, and someone puts up their hand and says, you know, we've got, you know, 40,000 things online. And, you know, my jaw is like on the floor. It's like, seriously, dude, you know, why do I not know about this? Because they just don't, they're not out there trumpeting what they're doing like US librarians tend to do. But then we've got these areas like, I just wish the California Digital Library would say more about the scholarship initiative, because I think it's just the bee's knees. It's just, they do amazing work there now. I mean, after I left, obviously they're just doing amazing stuff.
Well, you were there in Berkeley for 20 something years, but
yeah.
You ended up ending your career with a dozen years or so at OCLC. What made you want to make the jump over there? What challenges were they offering you there?
Yeah. At the California Digital Library, I got to a point after working with the scholarship and getting that to a certain point, and then I kind of morphed into another role. I basically fell on the sword of metasearch, if you will. So after the scholarship work, I was essentially tasked with dealing with the fact that we had all these dozens of databases and no good way to search them. And so I spent a few years actually building a metasearch system that based on Ex Libris, mm-hmm. Their MetaLib product, but actually making it usable. And we actually got, I think, a very interesting, very usable product to a point at essentially the wrong time. So right when we were being successful, the whole ecosystem shifted, and then it was all about central index and all of that. So essentially, in that one case, my timing was completely off. And so when that kind of crashed and burned, I was looking around, and I think I felt like I was done at the California Digital Library. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure what else I could really contribute there. And so when I looked around the landscape, and I said, who's in the best position to actually make widespread systemic change happen? And the only place I could think of that had that opportunity, and this is right after RLG and OCLC had merged. Mm-hmm. So they became one, and I'm thinking, if anyone has the opportunity to make this kind of change, it's got to be OCLC. So that's when I approached them and said, you know, hey, I'd like to join you guys, the research division, which they had an office in, at that point it was Mountain View, which is 2 hours away by car. But so what I negotiated only going in the office twice a week and then, doing virtual from there. And so they, said yes. So I joined them in the research division. We were doing parallel processing on the WorldCat database. So we had probably a 40 node cluster of computers, and just some serious firepower that we could turn on. I mean, I could string search 400 million records in a matter of minutes, which is just crazy, using this system. But then also write programs to extract data, summarize it, and report back on it.
If, like, I don't know, if human life was extended and you were not at what you considered your retirement age, what issues in the library world would you still want to be, like, pursuing with a passion? Like, what do you see out there that you feel like you could be instrumental in helping out with?
There's one, and that's the bibliographic transformation. We still are saddled with 1960s era technology called MARC, and, well, it's much deeper than that. So it's not just MARC. It's, of course, all the decisions that were made along the way. It's ISBD punctuation. It's just an accretion of errors. But let me put it this way. Our metadata infrastructure is crumbling. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And I don't need to lay blame at any one doorstep. But essentially, we've got a really big lift to bring our data into the 21st century. Our hopes are pinned on this BibFrame thing, but I don't, you know, BibFrame is just the carrier, if you will. Essentially, the problem is much bigger than that. So I've been down and dirty in looking at this metadata for a number of years, and it's an unholy mess. And we need to do things like cleaning it up and parsing it, more fine-tuned boxes, if you will. The granularity is not sufficient to do what we need to do with it. So there's a lot of power that's hidden in the data, but we can't do anything with it because it is hidden, and it's hidden in various ways. So I see the need to transform our bibliographic infrastructure is the single biggest issue facing libraries today. So I look around, and we're doing a lot of good work in various ways, but there's no, like, big issue that I think is bigger than this one. And it worries me that we don't know how to make the transition in a good way.
Well, is there anything else in the library space that's kind of, even if it's not something that you would personally be doing, anything else that's, like, really exciting to you in technology that you're kind of, even in retirement, looking from the outside of, you're excited to see how it goes and how it works out?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Change seems to happen in peaks and plateaus. And I almost feel like the bulk of my career was, weathering a peak. And I feel like now we're kind of in a plateau. I look around and sure, there's interesting things, 3D printers here and, whatnot over here. But is there any huge change? I just don't see it. I think we're in this plateau kind of situation where we're just kind of going along until the next big thing comes along. And I'm not sure that that's come along yet. I haven't seen something I'd say, okay, that's going to transform libraries like we did the internet and computers to begin with. I just don't see it.
Yeah, but then at some point that web is always around the corner, it seems like, and we don't see it coming, but it's probably coming, so, and we'll have to
Oh,
deal with it.
no, I totally agree. I totally agree that there will be another peak coming along. We don't know when it's going to happen and what it's going to look like. I mean, it's almost guaranteed, but I just don't think it's come yet.
Yeah, and hopefully at some point, I mean, I guess it's always been a thing of librarians maybe won't need to be dragged into the next change, but I'm sure we will.
Yeah, the funny thing is that, and I saw this happen at Berkeley when we went from Gopher to the web, is we dragged them into Gopher, and then we had to drag them kicking and screaming out of Gopher. So it's like, once it becomes a new normal, they just don't want to give it up. And that's just the way, that's just human nature. I mean, a lot of people, especially people who've been, doing the same job year in, year out for a while, they don't want to learn, have to learn something new. They want to be able to just punch their time card, so.
Well, looking back kind of on your career, what would you say is the thing that you're maybe the most proud of, or the most that you're happy that you were involved with, or something like that? Something that made that you feel like you made the most difference in librarianship?
Well, excuse me, it probably has to be crossing the internet threshold, because that was transformative for a lot of people. And I still have people come up to me and say, "Hey, I learned about the internet, on your book or in your workshop." And that was a truly transformative change for libraries. So I think that's probably got to be what I point to.
Okay, yeah, I learned a lot coming up into libraries from your Library Journal column, so that was very helpful to me in my early days in the career, so.
Well, good. And that was a lot of fun for me to do as well. So I was, and by the way, I was the one who actually pitched that to Library Journal. I said, "Hey, you need a column on digital libraries, and I'm the one to write it." And I was lucky enough that they said yes.
Sometimes our journals had to be dragged into the future as well, so.
Yeah, because that was in the early mid-90s, and they still weren't, I think, completely clued in.
Yeah,
So.
me and a couple of other podcasters are trying to nudge Library Journal into getting a podcast, because every publication has a podcast, but they don't yet. So we're trying to nudge them into that. So.
Well, good for you. Yeah.
All right, well, Roy, thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us all about your career. Like I said, I've followed your career for a long time. I've read your column and everything, and a few of your books when I was coming up into librarianship in the early 2000s. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and help you share your story with my listeners.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
All right, and if people wanted to follow up with you, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, I'm roytennant@gmail.com, and my website is roytennant.com. So that's pretty much it.
Buddy's retired, to leave him alone.
No. Always happy to hear from my library colleagues.
Great. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Roy, and have a great retirement.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place of work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit circulatingideas.com and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or a review. You can follow the show on Twitter @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thanks for listening, and keep circulating your ideas. Thanks again to Mometrics Test Preparation for sponsoring this episode of the podcast.
To get 10% off your first purchase and a free demo, visit goelibrary.com and use that promo code podcast. That's goelibrary.com, promo code podcast.